Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Elliot Rains, who's currently directing a very powerful version of the play Terra Nova for the Players Theater in Sarasota. Elliot's story is somewhat unusual. Actor, teacher of acting, lawyer, actor, director. It isn't your normal through line, and it makes for a very interesting story. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about self-discovery. Now, for some people, this may seem an odd thing to try and do, to discover a self with whom I have lived all of my life. How could I not know the self that I am? But, as a psychotherapist, who's been in practice for more than 30 years, I have seen over and over again that we human beings don't always know who we are. In fact, sometimes we are the last to know who we are. In fact, sometimes everyone else knows more about us than we do. How can this be? Well, if you've been listening to the show, you've heard me say this over and over and over and over again, but I will continue to say it over and over again because it's not an easily accepted fact for most of us. I believe that in order to survive the family into which we have been born, and this doesn't mean dysfunctional or abusive families, all families, in my experience, have an idea about the way their children should be. There are roles which need to be played, and these roles are not determined by your parents. They're determined by the parents they had and the ones before them and the ones before them. These ideas about the good and bad, the right and wrong, the appropriate and inappropriate, these things get passed down from generations, and they're not conscious. They're reflexive. They're unconscious. They're intuitive. This is right. This is wrong. This is good. This is bad. This is, I'm not sure. Now, obviously, some families are more flexible than others. Some parents have more tolerance than others. But mostly, all parents have some ideas. And they're not the same across the board. I know a parent who had been raised by a family that did not really allow her to express herself. She felt stifled and shy about her opinions and unable to really be assertive about what she wanted or needed or thought, for that matter. So obviously this is someone who was able to deny an ability to be forthcoming. Well, she had a little boy, and this little boy began quite young to demonstrate a very powerful sense of himself, which of course she had too, because pretty much all children do. She was enamored of this behavior in this little boy. She thought this was terrific. This was a little boy who was not going to buckle, not going to be shy, So she encouraged that behavior in that child, not realizing that at the very same time, she was discouraging the ability to be quiet, the ability to wait and see, the ability to let others participate, to share. She encouraged a kind of assertiveness, an extreme, really, at the same time discouraging a kind of thoughtfulness, comfort with quiet. So this mother was in denial for, unable to access her ability to be assertive, and her son in denial for, unable to access his ability to lay back and let others lead. Now, both of these qualities are important. The ability to be forthcoming, to say, this is what I want, this is what I need, this is what I think, to participate in the social intercourse so that your thoughts are made known, so that what you need can be manifest. They're very important, obviously, but the other side is also important. The ability to let another lead, to be open to other opinions, to rest, for God's sakes, to be quiet, to be thoughtful. This is also very important. So what we had here was a mother who didn't have the one and the son who didn't have the other. And this is through no fault of anybody's. This is what felt right. This is what felt natural. This is what felt appropriate. Okay, so in my view, to some extent, this is happening to all of us. Something about us is being encouraged and something about us is being discouraged. And the thing that is being discouraged, I label as going undercover. And the things about us which were encouraged, I label as being a part of our cover story. Much like a spy, we have what we present as is true of us. Now, of course, with a spy, they're hiding things about themselves, their nationality, their political position, any, I don't know what else a spy might be hiding. But a spy is hiding these things in order not to be in danger, not to be discovered as who they really are. And I think we're doing the same thing. We are hiding those aspects of ourselves because the danger is that it will not be appreciated, approved of, loved, tolerated even, or it might be punished by our family of origin, or our peers, or the culture in which we live. And this is not tolerant, not tolerable, certainly not from our family of origin. If our family of origin doesn't like us, we know perfectly well that that is a dangerous thing. So the difference between us and the spy is that the spy knows what it's hiding. And when it is in a safe place, it can be, well, he or she can be him or herself. We are not so fortunate. We manage to hide these qualities so well that we have forgotten that we have them. The mother in this case, quite unable to say, no, I don't like that, don't do that, or this is what I want. And her speech patterns continually had sentences like, I don't care, whatever you want, that's okay. Anything's okay with me. And of course, her son didn't have those sentences, phrases, idioms in his vocabulary. He had the more directive, more insistent, more demanding language. Now, why is this important? Well, I think it's self-evident, but I'll say it anyway, even though, as I said, I think it's self-evident and I have said it many times. It's unfortunate and ironic, but quite often it is precisely the quality which we have had to deny, which is the one that we need later in life in order to live a full and satisfying life, even to live the life we were meant to live, the life that is instinctive to us. And so, of course, a lot of people wind up in therapy looking for the very thing they have denied. You know that old idiom about, you know, you can find what you've been searching for right in your own backyard? Well, that turns out to be the truth a lot of the time in therapy. People come into therapy wanting to do something they don't think they can do, or wanting to stop something that they think they can't stop. And quite often the capacity, the ability is there inside them, deeply hidden under cover. And the work is to first help the person become aware of it, to recognize that it was always there and simply needs to be accessed. And I'm sorry I used the word simply, because of course it is not simple. There are big obstacles to accessing what we have denied. We denied it for a very good reason, because there was a danger attached to knowing it and using it. And we still believe in that danger, even if the danger is not accurate, isn't true. We still believe in it. So somebody deep inside of us is resisting it. And quite often the danger is still there. Not in the way it was for us as a child, but still, there is a price. And that reminds me that I wrote a book about this called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And what reminded me about it is that there's a chapter in the book called The Price and the Payoff. So this might be a good time to say that you could find the book. You can find pretty much anything you might want to know about me on my website, thelynnshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave the E out of Lynn, S-H-O-W, thelynnshow.com. You can find the book. You can find an article on therapy on the phone called Therapy on the Go, which is how I do all my therapy these days. And if you want to talk to me, there's a space for email me and ask me any questions you want about what it's like to do therapy on the phone, questions about change, or you could listen to all of the interviews that I've done, including the one I'm playing today. This is an interview with Elliot Raines, and Elliot is particularly interesting to me because Elliot is someone who, at age 27 or 28, discovered something about himself that was so potent, so important, that he stopped on a dime the life and career he'd been aiming at, studying for, working at, and switched gears in a heartbeat. This suggests a capacity to self-knowledge, to recognizing what he may have been in denial for until that moment, and then being able to act on it. So in some ways, Elliot is a perfect example of what I'm hoping you're all, considering. That there might be something that you could know about yourself that would change the way you're living and make you happier or more fulfilled or more comfortable. And in Elliot's case, he was not only able to do that, but then to shift back to the thing he'd been doing before, which of course was acting and directing, which is how I come to interview him. So you can hear that story And you can hear how it evolved, and hopefully it will be encouraging, useful for you right now. So here is Elliot Raines. So I'm here with Elliot Raines in his lovely home. And I've not yet explained to Elliot, so I will now. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Now, I know that you are currently directing a play at the Players in Sarasota. So I'm assuming that the art to which you have either given parts of your life and or made a living with at some time is the theater and maybe even directing. Is that accurate?
Pretty much so. I've been involved in theater and acting pretty much my whole life. I've been on stage literally since I'm 4 years old.
Yeah, well, that's my question. I only ask one question, and it is, how did it start? When was the first moment? I mean, if you were on stage when you were four, then that suggests to me that before four, somebody had the idea that you might like it, be good at it, be cute, I don't know. So do you know when was the very first moment in the life of Elliot Raines that acting and or theater raised its head?
I don't know. I'm not aware personally of it, but I've been told.
Oh, yes, fine.
That when I was 3 years old in shul, in synagogue, while they were praying, I would be in my little cowboy outfit with my six guns.
Performing.
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just want to explain that Elliot has his hands in the air and he's shooting his guns. Right.
Up in the air. Right. And I guess from that start...
So they thought they had a little actor on their hands.
Or somebody who was really hyper, one or the other.
When were you on stage at four? I mean, what were you doing?
Oh, this was up in a... It was a Jewish bungalow colony up in the Catskills. Ironically, the name of the bungalow colony was Lebanon.
Very cute. So, at the bungalow colony, as a four-year-old, did they have, like...
They had... It was basically a circus, as I remember it, and I was the ringmaster. And I remember having a little laugh. I actually think there's still a picture, if I went ferreting, of me in this. Well, that would take a long time to find. But with me, like, in a top hat. And what I remember is standing in the center, and the counselor would come up and whisper the lines to me. Then I would say them out. Then when my next set of lines was to come up, they'd come to whisper it to my ear. And then I would say it out.
This is hilarious.
I actually still remember this.
Clearly. So again, I mean, this was really a pivotal moment because it is so clear that you remember it. So it had so much power for you.
Pivotal, I don't know if it was pivotal. I never thought of it in those terms. The way you phrase it, it makes sense. Because
I'm talking to you about it and you were four.
And it's 55 years later.
Exactly.
So I grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, mm-hmm. Second generation. Now it's called the East Village. When I grew up there, it was called a slum. I spent 12 years there until we moved to Brooklyn. And I got a wonderful education at the yeshiva. It was funny, back in those days, I guess, the girls had the alto voices.
Yes.
And the boys had the soprano voices. And one of the things I remember doing is, I don't remember what show or what thing that we were doing, but I remember being behind a pillar in the synagogue, which was the stage, and singing the girl's part while she was mouthing it on stage, because I had...
You had the voice.
Yeah, and she didn't.
Wow.
That was...
Well, okay, so what we have here is some pretty powerful memories pretty early on of being on stage or of performing. So did you decide you wanted to do that?
My parents always thought that it would look good on a resume and be good for a well-rounded education go to different schools and go to different outside classes. I remember being 8 years old and taking piano lessons and taking music theory.
Yeah.
The music theory has been very useful in my life. The piano lessons were almost a complete waste of time because all I wanted to do was to be playing baseball outside when I'm taking piano lessons. When I was 7 years old, my parents sent me to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts for a year.
Wow.
My sister went to the Joffrey Ballet School and was involved with them for a while.
Yeah.
And she had taken violin and piano. I had taken piano.
Yeah, they were serious about giving you a well-rounded education. Yes. And that you should know everything. Yes. That there was to know about everything.
And, you know, the area that we lived in was, you know, I think if they wanted us to experience things beyond that neighborhood. You know, the neighborhood was a difficult neighborhood. Just a tough neighborhood back in that time frame. The Lower East Side was...
Yeah, the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
Right, right, exactly. Okay, so this is all your early life. Then you go to high school. Are you involved in the...
I'm involved in high school in what they call SING, which is the sophomores, juniors, seniors, each group creates their own show. And it's a musical, and it's usually not original music, but it's original lyrics put to known songs. And it's a competition that is, well, at least was common back in the 60s and 70s, and I think in the 80s, and you did that. Also, in the high schools, they had a drama workshop, which was a very active program.
And you were in all that?
I was, yeah. And they had a chorus I was involved in. High school was probably my favorite school in terms of all the schooling that I did.
Because it was all this stuff.
Yeah, it was all this stuff. I spent a lot of hours in high school. About when I was there for the day, I would probably be there as a senior, because it was a huge school and it was on triple shift. So as a senior, my normal day would start at 8 and the normal day would probably end about 1:30. But between drama workshop and all the other stuff, going back and forth, because fortunately I lived real close to the school, I probably wouldn't get home overall till easily 7, 8, 9 at night.
Wow. Wow. Okay, so were you thinking then that theater or acting or singing or something was going to be your future? Or
I was probably my dream.
Yes.
And I pursued it. I went to college. I got a BA in theater. Then after that, I got a Master of Fine Arts in Acting from the University of Illinois.
Oh, so you were serious.
Yeah, and which I taught there for a year. Then from that point on, I went back to New York. Many of my friends went up to Chicago and did very good work up there. I went back to New York to pursue my dream. At a certain point, eating became important to me.
Yeah, right. It's hard.
And then I went to law school. Actually, what did it for me was to be very specific about what my job is as a professional actor. And one of the things that I despise most in this world is looking for work. Once I have a job, I'm doing fine. But one thing I despise most is looking for work. Once I really sat down and as I was pursuing it, realizing that even when I'm successful, 90% of my job was going to be looking for work. I applied to law schools the following week.
Wow. Well, you know, this is really interesting. Because I've never heard anybody say anything quite like that. And it suggests, for me anyway, a really high degree of self-awareness, you know?
Thank you.
No, I'm serious, you know. I mean, you actually said to yourself, essentially, what am I good at, what am I bad at, what am I comfortable with, what am I not? And you saw it very clearly, and then you acted on it. Because I'm thinking that when you decided to go to law school, you thought, well, and if I get a job, I won't have to keep looking for work, right? And that somehow being a lawyer was not a terrible idea. I mean, that you thought that would be an okay thing to do.
Yes. What I figured is once I realized that I'm going to have to work 9 to 5, what can I do to maximize my income? And basically, it was saying to myself, what can I do? And I enjoyed law. It wasn't that I hated it or loved it, but I enjoyed it. I liked it a lot. I said to myself, what can I maximize my income at? And I said to myself, if I do the same work, I'll make 3 times the salary as a lawyer with a law degree behind my name than without the law degree behind my name.
This is true. Right. So you went to law school. Yeah.
And I apologize. And I looked at it from that point in the scheme of things. While 3 years looks amazingly onerous at this moment in time, about to do it,
right,
I realized that in the scheme of things, it's going to be a blip in time.
Yeah, you were terrifically self-aware. How old were you?
28. Yeah. 27, 28.
It's unusual, I think. So did you have an idea of what kind of law we were going to...
At that point, I thought I would end up in entertainment and contract law. Because one of the other things that got me interested in it was I had a manager that was interested in using me. And he presented the contract to me, and my father at that time had a friend who was an attorney, so I went over to him, and I enjoyed the way he analyzed the process, and I thought that would be something fun to do. So when I entered law school, I thought entertainment law, would be a natural segue.
Right.
Except that contract law has got to be the most boring stuff on the planet Earth. And I stopped doing that. I discounted that idea early on.
It's one thing to be willing to work 9 to 5, but not to be working at the most boring thing in the world.
Right. So I actually then, I graduated law school, And I then got involved, and I actually got a job in an area of law that I did not even know existed in law school. Now they have some of it, but I didn't even know it existed. I was hired by an agency called the Mental Hygiene Legal Service, which is a state agency in New York that represents psychiatric inpatients.
You're kidding.
In every hospital, in every psychiatric facility in the state of New York.
Wait a minute. Psychiatric facilities hire lawyers?
Oh, yes. No, not the facility. It's a state agency called the Mental Hygiene Legal Service.
So are you an advocate for psychiatric patients? Is that what it is?
That's exactly what your job is. Your job is to represent and protect their rights.
Wow.
For court hearings where they have certain rights, from abuse in the facility if that occurs, and you track it down.
So did they dismantle that agency
still
when
in
they
existence, still there. Still
even
works.
Though they now are dumping all the mental patients into the street, they still have the agency.
Dumping all the mental patients into the street hasn't really quite A, worked, nor B, actually been effectuated in the last decade or so. The theory behind it is a wonderful theory. The theory behind not housing them in youth institutions is a wonderful idea, to house them in smaller areas, in smaller group homes where people can have more one-to-one connection and have social services and social work that is useful to them. What ended up happening, to my understanding, in New York was that once they did this, there was no money to fund these things.
Right.
So they put these people in less than savory places.
Right.
Right. But the idea is one.
No, I agree. I agree. And there's no argument with that. Okay, so you're now in this. This is an interesting, it's just interesting. I mean, had you found in yourself previous to this an interest in being an advocate? I mean, that's very different.
I was more concerned about getting a job.
Getting a job. That's what I'm thinking. So it wasn't that you were
It
was just that this was the job that came up and...
This found me.
It found you.
For lack of a better word. You know, maybe kismet, maybe...
Meant to be.
Karma, yeah, whatever. You know.
Yeah, right. It's Bashert.
Bashert, right. Exactly.
Right. So I'm assuming, because you say it's Bashert, that you took to it, that you were good at it, that you liked it, something like that.
I enjoyed it. I liked it very much. I I eventually became the supervising attorney in my office of a three attorney group. And then one day, I was doing this for about 5 years, and one day I was litigating in court, and the judge to whom I was litigating in front of called me up to a sidebar and said to me that her law secretary was retiring. Would I like a job and be her law secretary?
Wow. Did that sort of thing happen much?
Not to my knowledge. And I pondered it for a day, and then I said yes. A significant salary bump right off the bat.
Right.
And it's a different position. I went from working as an advocate outside the court system,
right,
working inside
court
system. Right.
Right.
Now I was the law clerk to the judge who made these decisions. My judge finally retired in 1997. A wonderful lady, Judge Maxine K. Duberstein. They kept me on the court system as what's called a court attorney special referee matrimonial. So what I did was I ended up staying in the mental hygiene part, and I worked with those judges that came into the mental hygiene part.
Yeah, well, by that time you knew everything there was to know from both sides of the street, right?
Yes.
So during this time, did you do any acting, any directing, any theater?
I actually had not. Kismet. I actually had not done any acting for about 11 years. Nine years. The last thing I had done was an opera at the Beacon Theater in 1980, New York Lyric Opera, called Les Rois Dix. And I was really there because back then I had stage combat expertise. I still have a little bit, but unfortunately I forgot a lot. And there were some fight scenes in the opera. So I was really hired for that purpose more than my caterwauling. that was the last thing I had done. That was sort of right before I started law school. And it was funny. I would go see a play. But couldn't even imagine I used to do that. How did I ever have the chutzpah to get up on that stage and do that? And then when I was representing the patients, there was a DA who happened to be involved in theater. He was directing the play. He was directing Come Blow Your Horn. And he asked me to play Buddy, the younger brother.
Did he know that you
had... Yeah, we had talked.
Oh, right.
We had talked. Right. We've gone out to lunch together.
Right.
It's not a dog-eat-dog world as it sometimes, you know, you yell and scream at each other in court and then you go, okay, so where are we going for lunch?
Right.
So I did that play, and...
Were you happy, excited, and anxious? Do you remember?
Scared, blipless.
Yeah, that's what I'm imagining, because you said you...
Oh, I was...
But you did it anyway.
It was fun to do, and that got me back into doing.
Oh, and then you remembered. You said, "Oh, I see now."
Pretty much. And then I used to be frustrated with a lot of the directors that I worked with, because it seemed to me that as an actor, I tended to be more prepared than they were, and that really should never be. And I always used to say to myself, you know, if I had the opportunity to do it, I would do it this way. I would have the opportunity to do it this way. I would have the opportunity, do it this way. And finally, there was an opportunity to direct a witness for the prosecution. And it was Tuchus auf den Tisch time. Tuchus auf den Tisch literally means ass on the table, tushy on the table.
That's right.
What it figuratively means is put up or shut up.
That's right.
Or my favorite, which my late father would say, defecate or abdicate, which love.
Yes,
Right, so I would be a lawyer by day and a director by night. I had a reasonably 9-to-5 job, so I could plan to get out of work and get home by 5:30 and change my clothing and get out to rehearsal, because I lived in Brooklyn and the rehearsals were out in Forest Hill, Queens, which is another half an hour out. I always like to get to rehearsal a half an hour early and set up my space.
So you make it out to Forest Hills and you direct, and you like it.
Yes, and I continue to direct out there, and I directed several plays there.
So this is great. So you find yourself back in that, and that feels So you've got the best of all possible worlds here. You do have your 9-to-5 job. You don't have to look for work. You are making money. And you have this thing now. You don't have to look for work, and you're getting to do it, right?
Pretty much.
And so you're maybe tired, but other than that, it's working for you.
Mostly, yeah. It's just exhausting, you know.
It is physically challenging, both of these things that you're doing.
Yeah.
Okay, so you do that until 2000 and something, and then...
I'd say until 2003, pretty much.
And then what happened?
Then my job changed. My judge retired, and they made me a court attorney special referee matrimonial. Special referee matrimonial is a glorified paper pusher, but in uncontested divorces is the equivalent of the judge.
Oh.
So I sign off on
you sign off on
I
right,
basically
right.
make sure that all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed.
Right. All the, oh, my God, you wound up doing contracts after all.
Yeah. And if they are, and I've done a lot of those. I've done thousands of those.
Well, it's nice to know there are uncontested divorces.
Yeah. Yeah, most of them are, actually. Statistically, most of them are.
Ha! Huh. Okay, good. So you have this job, which is boring but still paying, and at night you're doing this thing, which is exciting and exhausting.
Yes.
So, okay, so then?
Well, then the former administrative judge, the Honorable Michael J. Pesci, who I'm still in communication with, Judge Doug Dubenstein unfortunately passed away, but I'm still asked specifically for me to be his law clerk.
Oh, I got it.
And when a judge asks that, you don't say no.
No. Right.
And he's a wonderful guy. He's a great guy. But it was an area of the law that I knew zero about. Related area, but not one that I ever dealt with before, guardianship. Adults, people who are incapacitated.
Oh,
all
yeah,
the way
right.
the monies are being held, make sure they're not getting ripped off. So I need to become an expert on guardianship real fast.
Mm.
So I worked with him for, I worked with him for a while, but that was, that basically did not allow me to do anything outside of the house anymore for a few years.
Did you mind?
I needed a creative outlet. So I actually started playing guitar when I was 47 years old. I played when I was younger. I played acoustic, Michael Rowe, the Phil Oaks,
Even
a little Cat Stevens in the 70s. But in terms of trying to play jazz and blues guitar, single note stuff, I needed a creative outlet. So I would sit in front of the boob tube watching a sporting event. And the only way I could justify that was to practice scales, and I would walk practice, and I would just sort of mindlessly do that, and suddenly after several months, I was going,
wow,
geez, not bad. I'm not great, but not bad.
Mm-hmm.
But it gave me a creative outlet until I was able to start doing theater again.
So how long did you have to do that before you could...
Well, I wasn't able to do theater again really in New York until I retired.
And when did you retire?
I retired in January 2008, and then my job called me back in the summer to try to, I was doing a special guardianship project back then, and basically what it was closing out a lot of old guardianships that slipped through the cracks on technicalities and other things like that. So I was doing a lot of that stuff at that point.
You must be awfully good at detail, even if you don't particularly like it.
I am good at detail. I am a very specific
person. Yeah, right, very.
If you ever take a look at any of my scripts, the way I break them down, I am a very specific person. I've worked out every line of the play. I leave nothing to chance.
Wow.
I've worked out every line of the play. I've worked out every setup. I've worked out every payoff. I've worked through every beat, and I've worked it line by line with actors.
Wow.
So there was nothing left to chance. So everything is set up and everything is paid off, and to me that breeds confidence with the actor because they know exactly where and when they're going on everything because everything is based on the emotion. I direct based on the emotional truth of the moment, what's going on at that moment in time. Acting is a very simple thing. It's not easy, but it's very simple to me. It's what do I want and how bad do I want it with passion. And if the answer to the second question ain't real bad, rethink your answer because it's wrong. Because if you on stage don't care about it, why should the audience care about it?
Right.
This is just 2 + 2. This is just logic. If you don't give a crap, why should they?
Right. So for you, what you are looking for in an actor, and also helping an actor if they don't come to it spontaneously, to find the care, the desire, the passion, the need, in the moment.
To find all the moments, absolutely.
Right.
That's absolutely. And I'm not waiting. And my job, I look at my job as a director, is to shape the play. That's really what my job is to shape the play, to shape the performances, to shape the actors. And one thing that I always like to have is I always tell my actors, I want you to feel comfortable in the rehearsal space. If there's anything in the rehearsal space that's getting in the way of your comfort, you let me know and we'll try to work it out. Because 9 times out of 10, when an actor tries something, they're going to look like a complete jerk. And that's as nice way as I can phrase it. But you have to be comfortable enough to try it the first 9 times, so when the 10th time you do it and it's brilliant,
right,
you can get there. You're not going to ever get to number 10 without number 9, the first 9 in front. So I always advocate that, and I always advocate, I want the actors to take possession of the part. I have worked out everything, but that doesn't mean that's the way it's going to be. I always invite and I always welcome my actors' input. I want you guys to, I ask tons of questions and I want you to ask me questions and give me feedback. And my philosophy is, if it's as good as my idea or better, we go with their idea, because it's important for them to take possession of it. And I always tell them, I'm not wedded to my idea. I'm wedded to the best idea. And I always tell them, because I'm going to get credit for it anyway. What do I get?
Can you give me an example?
There are a lot of them in this play.
We should just say, you're directing Terra Nova. We'll talk a little bit more about that, as long as you're going to talk about this play, you're directing Terra Nova, which is going to open at the Players on
June 21st through 24th, and then it's going to be going on again July 19th through 22nd.
Okay.
It's going in repertory with Taffetas and Lettuce and Lovage. Taffetas is going on the week before, and Lettuce and Lovage is going on the week after. And please see all 3 shows. They'll all be wonderful.
Okay, good. All right, so now, as long as we're on the play, why don't you say something about the play and how this happened, why it's this play, why you're doing it, any of that?
This play was picked by the Players. I think this is a play that's very close to Jeff Kinn, the artistic director's heart. And he offered me this wonderful opportunity to direct it. Basically what the play is in the winter of 1911-1912, 2 expeditions set forth to reach the South Pole first. One was Norwegian, one was British. Only the Norwegians came back. Wow. This is the story of the British.
Okay, all right.
So
was this a play you knew before?
No.
Wow.
No, I didn't know this play existed. I'd be curious for the experience, but I've never directed a play I've picked.
Never directed a play you picked?
Any play that I've ever it was a play that I was asked to direct from a group. I've never actually gone, I'd like to direct this play, and can we do it?
Yeah.
Though hopefully that'll happen in the future.
If you can, an example of a way in which you helped an actor, any actor, any time in your career, to find the passion, the care that was or wasn't there.
Well, basically, it has to do with me, for example, of the moments, of talking about the specific moments in a play and asking questions. The one thing that I noticed down here, not even down here, but everywhere, is actors don't seem to give themselves permission to be big, to try stuff, to expand. It's what I always tell as an actor, be as big as you want to be. It's much easier for me, you're helping me as a director, it's much easier for me as a director to take you down than to build you up.
Yeah.
Be big. And what I have found is when most actors think they're being way too big, they're pretty much being right on.
Yeah.
It's just that they're never big enough. There's never quite enough sense of urgency, never quite enough sense of importance, never quite enough sense. What they think they're doing is not quite as much as... Because you can't see yourself. I mean, how can you see yourself?
Well, I wonder if it isn't something else also. That there isn't a kind... Well, that there isn't a sense of not wanting to show off, not wanting to be embarrassed, not wanting to be foolish. Do you think not that's not there at all?
I sometimes think it's there, but it's something I really work to get away from.
Clearly. But what I'm saying is that may be the motivation behind the play it down, play it down.
Oh, I didn't think of that, but that makes perfect sense. What your sense that you'll be inappropriate to the moment.
Yes.
But you're not. I can understand that from the actor's point of view, but it's the actor sort of has to trust. The actor has difficult to do because you have to then be able to trust the director, and you sometimes have direct. And not all directors are trustworthy. Some of them are wonderful, but some are less so.
Yes, and I think that's a very important point, that you have to be willing to trust the director.
You sort of have to. It's once you get cast in the play, you sort of have to. If not,
you shouldn't be there.
Right. Also, I think it's something for an actor to not feel obligated to be in the play if he's not happy with the director or not happy with the circumstance. When I was an actor, I would give myself 1 week in any play, because beyond that, then you're starting to impact the other acting performances. Because, especially if you're not getting paid for it,
right?
Am I getting out what I'm putting in? If I'm not getting out what I'm putting in and I'm not getting paid for it, then why am I doing this? What the heck is wrong with me? And if I made it, within a week's time, if I can make the decision that I'm not going to get out what I'm putting in, I felt I was comfortable enough to quit the show at that point in time.
Yeah.
Beyond that, then I think I'm impacting negatively on everybody else.
Right.
And I think it's unfair. You can't quit a show 2 weeks into it, 3 weeks into it. But that first, it's a 6 week run. I'm in the show 5 days and I leave it.
Someone else can pick it up.
Yeah.
What I'm thinking here is, correct me if I'm wrong, but you seem to have a very lovely, strong sense that you can do what is right for you, and that the world will accept that, accommodate it. All that stuff you were saying about, I give it a week, and I think there are a lot of people who could not say that. I got myself in this thing, and I'm stuck with it because I can't get out. So there's a kind of sense that you're the captain of your fate. To the extent that you can do it, you will do what you need to do at any given moment. Does that feel wrong?
No, I think that makes a lot of sense in the way I believe about things. One of the things I try never to be, what I always try to do is take responsibility for my life.
Yes.
Because you're either responsible or you're a victim, and there's nothing in between. And I'm not going to be a victim. Being a victim means somebody else is in control of my life. And while I clearly can, I can have a heart attack tomorrow.
Right.
But as much as I can comfortably do, in terms of determining my own life, is what I'd like to do.
Yeah.
I think it's appropriate for people to do. Otherwise, other people are going to do it, and they may not do it in a fashion that you are happy with.
Yeah, this is exactly what I was thinking. And, I think this is something you get from your family. Do you think you got that from them? I mean, all the encouragement to do everything.
What I got from my parents was a strong, strong sense of education.
Yeah.
And how important education was to me. I will tell you, it was not a day in my life that didn't occur to me that I would at least go to college, if not beyond.
Yeah.
So that's what they gave me. But other stuff, I think, in my mid-20s, I was not the happiest kind of person. I think I was a very depressed kind of person, and I think I needed to find my own way of believing about certain things in order to basically have a decent life and not end it.
Yeah, to survive.
Yeah. And I found that, and I have found it's been useful to me since I'm maybe the age of 29 and 30, the way
you found a way to make sense of the world and your life, and it's worked for you.
Right.
It's clearly worked for you. It's lovely. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I hardly need to tell you that a lot of people find themselves in that spot and don't find something, So I suspect that that's a testament to something about you. When you had to, defecate or advocate, you chose
to defecate.
To defecate. Right. Well, no, truly. you chose life. You chose to find a way to make it work for you. It's wonderful, I think, and encouraging. Okay, so how did you get to Sarasota?
I got to Sarasota because of the 1994 California earthquake. Doesn't that make sense?
Well, it's how I got to Sarasota, so you want to tell me?
One of my best friends on the planet Earth, a fellow named Larry Barrett, who is a wonderful chef. He's the caterer for Simply Gourmet. Larry and I were, I met Larry in August of 1976. We were one of seven MFAs in the acting program at the University of Illinois.
Oh my God.
So that's where I met Larry, and we've been friends ever since. And I would go out to visit Larry in California.
Mm-hmm.
And the 1994 earthquake, Larry basically lived in ground zero. So 6 weeks later, they had relocated to Sarasota, and I would start to visit them down here. And then I visited them on my own. Then I got involved with a lovely woman who is now my wife. I was a bachelor till I was 50.
Wow.
So late in life. So we both came down here. We both fell in love with the place. And one thing led to another, and then we eventually bought this house down here with the plan of eventually moving down here. It's ironic that I fell in love with Sarasota area before even knowing how much theater there was involved here. I mean, I would have come down here regardless, you know, and done more music instead of theater. But what I don't use as a director is exactly what I do as a musician.
You don't improv?
Yes. I'm not a big fan of improv at all as an actor.
Right.
Because while it's a wonderful skill, it's a separate skill from acting.
Yes.
Completely. It's apples and oranges.
Yes.
And what improv is spontaneity. What acting is prepared spontaneity. It's a different, and you can't do one thing. I remember taking an improv class at a school that shall remain nameless many, many years ago. And my teacher, the professor, hated everything I did. I got frustrated, and I finally said, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to prepare three moments in every improv. And without fail, what the teacher liked in every one of my improvs was the three prepared moments that I already always did.
Wow.
So what that basically told me was there was a certain lack of use,
right,
for improv for acting.
Right.
It's a wonderful art in and of itself. I don't mean to denigrate it, but I don't think it applies to acting especially.
Okay, so you found yourself here. You found that there's a lot of theater, and you're directing. Are you also acting?
I don't really much like to act anymore. The last play I directed is a play called Yankee Tavern that was done at the Players Theater October.
Mm-hmm.
The show goes up on Thursday. My leading actor the Friday before cannot do the show, has some serious physical stuff, so he can't do the show. So I basically had to step into the lead after not being on stage for 13 years. To do the part. To tell you that I was scared S-less before, bleepless before, I was really scared bleepless now. But I went through it, and it came out fine.
Yeah, and that's another part of clearly who you are. You know, it has to be done, it has to be done.
Yeah, it really did. It came down to, at that moment in time, it's either be cancel the show or I'd go up and do it.
And that was never an option, right?
Well, it was briefly, but that became part of that thing, am I going to be a victim or am I not going to be a victim?
That was what I meant.
Am I going to be a victim of the illness here?
Of the circumstance.
Right, of the circumstance, or am I going to say, not me?
No, I'll take responsibility. That was the point I was trying to make. That's exactly right. Okay, so the only other question I ask is, having really given a life, on and off, albeit, but still a life, to theater, is there anything that you would say about it? What it's like, what it felt like, some kind of philosophical position, anything at all?
I would say, as a general rule, if you have a serious interest in doing theater for a livelihood, I would ask myself this question. Can you picture yourself being happy doing anything else whatsoever? If the answer to that question is yes, do not go into theater. Because theater is such a difficult, kick you in the teeth, reject you 99 out of 100 times for nothing remotely to do with you business, that unless you can't be happy, unless you are compulsed, you can't be happy doing anything else, one should never do it professionally. Had I known that 30 years ago, I would have saved myself a lot of grief. Because I could see myself being happy in other things. The second thing is having a viable alternate skill to earn money. Because an overnight success is 10 years in the making. And what are you going to do for those 10 years?
This is probably a very good place to stop. Thank you so much, Elliot. This was wonderful.
You're very welcome.
So Elliot says, ask yourself this question. Is there anything else you could be happy doing? Behind this question is the belief that you can know yourself. It's in everything Elliot says. His certainty that he can know himself and he can act on that knowledge so that he can live the life that is the closest to complete fulfillment, to what he considers to be success, to comfort and happiness. And of course, that's the theme of the Lynn Show, that it is possible to know yourself well enough so that you can create the circumstances, the environment, the situations that lead to the life that is most fitting for you. So thank you, Elliot, for that demonstration. And now, because this was a very long interview and I didn't want to cut any more than I had to, we're about to run out of time. So let me just thank Josh Hackney, as I always do, for his help, assistance, aid, comfort, kindness in everything remotely computer, recording, electronic. If you need anyone to help with any of these things, you want Josh, and you can get him by going to my website, thelinshow.com, where you can, of course, as I said, get me. And well, then let me just say that I really hope that you got something from this show that you can use. Something that interested you, intrigued you, turned you on, annoyed you even, if it will bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure, I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. was me and Sister Phoenix.